Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Quick reminder, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, any of those places. And downloading us would be a good life choice. Now, today, we are joined by the executive editor of the Bulwark, Jonathan V. Last. Thanks for joining me. Appreciate it very much.
Hey, Charlie. How are you doing?
Good. You know, I'm debating where to start. You and I are both looking at the Time magazine cover picture of Joe Biden, the test case, boundaries in the age of Trump. And right before we started, I was looking at this picture and going, this is not a flattering picture. Time magazine, you know, it is interesting. When they ran AOC on the cover, they made her look like a cross between, I don't know, Evita and Joseph Stalin. I don't know, but it was a beautiful picture, clearly airbrushed. This makes Joe Biden look like he's about 100 years old. He's usually immaculately dressed. He looks awkward. It's not a good picture, is it?
No. So if you look closely at it, it's like my graphic design nerd view. He's actually, because he is bursting through the page and reaching out to shake hands with his right hand, his shoulders are tilted and his left shoulder is dipped down. So this is why he looks awkward. Like everything about him looks unbalanced. Now, my question on this is whether this was a photo shoot he participated in or whether they have just taken an old photo of him and wiped everything else out and put it on here. And I don't know what the answer is. I find it difficult to believe he participated in a photo shoot for this story, though, because he wants this all to be taken care of and put to bed without as much participation from him as possible.
Yeah. Now I want to get into the power ranking that you did, the top 10 Democrats. But since we're on Joe Biden, you know, you've had a take on all of this. What did you think of his video where he's trying to explain that? I get it. I get the personal space thing.
Yeah, it's not good. Is it? My view of this is that I actually don't think this micro scandal or whatever, where I sort of refer to it as Dawson Gate and in honor of the late, great Richard Dawson, who's the host of Family Feud, who was famous for, beloved for, guilty of, like, essentially molesting every single woman who came across the Family Feud stage, even if they were 105 years old. I mean, he was kissing and hugging and maybe not all the way to groping, but it was always, like, vaguely uncomfortable and everybody was in on the joke. I don't think any of that actually matters here. I don't think that anybody really cares about this, except for people who don't like Joe Biden already, which is the Bernie Sanders woke left. But what matters is his response to it. And if his response looks like an old guy who's lost his fastball, then that is going to signal weakness to Democratic voters who are looking to find somebody who, in addition to everything else, is not going to wilt when Trump comes after them.
Yeah, no, I do think that was one of the things that, he's basically saying, you know, I understand that, you know, since I got involved in politics, you know, since I got started in politics, what, in the, you know, Paleolithic era, he's sort of reminding people that he's been around forever and that he's 76 years old. But I just have to say, I am not, first of all, I want to make it clear, I am not a touchy guy. I'm not a handsy guy. I'm like the master of the awkward hug. Are you a physically demonstrative guy?
I am. I'm not a hugger. But I know people like Biden who are, right? And it's I don't want to speak. I don't want to make ethnic stereotypes, but it's kind of an Irish thing, you know, Italian thing. Like Irish and Italian folks, at least in my experience growing up in very sort of ethnic New Jersey, like they're the ones who are big huggers and backslappers. And, you know, they shake your hand and they clap your shoulder and they'll even chin chuck or tassel your hair. Like they're just touchy people.
And it makes me a little uncomfortable. I'm going to get all of that. But, you know, here's this moment where you step back and you go, okay, well, what happened to the Me Too movement? Because it starts off with Harvey Weinstein, starts off with sexual harassment, sexual assault, you know, power plays, humiliation of women, locking them in rooms, all of this sort of thing. And now we are actually having a national debate about personal space. Okay, so you've had people who are close talkers and they make you feel a little bit awkward. But close talking is not the same as pussy grabbing. It's not the same as sexual assault. No. It's the equivalent of bad parallel parking as opposed to the felonies that we've been talking about. So this whole debate, you know, can, you know, boundaries in the age of Trump. Okay, so I'm not a Joe Biden fan. I've never been a Joe Biden fan. You know, and I'm not a you know, I'm not a toucher. But on the other hand, clearly this guy is physically demonstrative in a friendly way, as a way of connecting with people. He's been through tragedies in his life, and perhaps this is the way that he copes, being able to be, you know, friendly and everything. There's no sense of self-gratification. Maybe I am just insufficiently woke. They don't seem to be power plays. It just seems to be that he's this guy that behaves this way. But again, personal space. When did we redefine violations of personal space in a friendly way as somehow a major issue? I mean, it's like people.
Yeah, well, I mean, except that, again, I don't think that this really is about that. I mean, this is about the Sandersites trying to keep Biden on the sidelines.
Yeah.
I mean, they want to push him out of the race before he gets in, because if you're Bernie Sanders, Biden is the biggest threat to you. And they've decided that they would rather try to keep him out of the race than drop this on his head 2 weeks from now or 3 weeks from now once he gets into the race. I think that's an interesting strategic choice. It suggests that they think he is more persuadable than I had assumed he was. But I really do. I mean, are people actually outraged about this?
Yeah,
I mean, is anybody who is open to voting for Joe Biden in any meaningful sense, left, right, or center, really freaked out about this? And I don't think so. I think it's basically a bunch of the Chapo Trap House types who, you know, who really want a socialist president, who are just using this to make hay. Don't you get that sense, too?
This is
a manufactured, like, simulacrum of a controversy.
Yeah, that's actually a good way of putting it, because there are these controversies, these outrages that no one's actually outraged about, but you just think theoretically somebody's outraged about it. Yes, he rubbed noses with a woman. He kissed a woman on the back of the head. This is just awful. Meanwhile, the president is floating the idea, and you started the week by writing about crazy people on the right. And so it seems appropriate to end the week with the fact that the president is seriously contemplating naming Herman Cain to the Federal Reserve Board. Herman Cain. And the only thing
But
what I love is the part is that, well, they're waiting for the background check in case it turns anything up. Oh, geez, what the hell could that be? I mean, Herman Cain, you know, let's go back before we get to the power ranking, because I think you and I share this sort of obsession about what it is about this political moment we're in, that there are so many crazy people. I mean, crazy people who have come out of the woodwork, and suddenly we take them more quasi seriously. And these are people who are, you know, not just the misfit toys, but as you put it in your piece on Monday, these are people that you quite clearly would not trust to take care of your kids. And yet they are in the conservative media. They are on punditries. They're on cable television. They write blogs. They melt down. What is it about this moment that not only feels like everyone's having a nervous breakdown, but that you have all of these bizarre individuals who have been empowered?
You know, that's an excellent question, and one that I've spent a lot of time thinking about. And to be clear, I don't count Herman Cain as a crazy. I don't count him in the Kurt Schlichter, Denise McAllister, Julie Kelly part of the world.
He's merely eccentric. It's actually the kinder digital era when you thought of Herman Cain as an eccentric. Okay, fair enough.
Right. But so I was thinking about, so where did this come from? And the answer is, it isn't new. Certainly it was there during the Obama administration with the birthers and the survivalists. And to some extent, they were probably, you know, in the way that, like, the gold bug thing was a real feature of the housing bubble, which gave rise to the Tea Party movement. And it was there during the Clinton years, certainly. Right. I mean, the people forget that there was a little tiny contingent of the Republican Party, which was actually crazy about Bill Clinton, and that believed that he was running a cocaine dealing ring from an airstrip in MENA. They believed that Vince Foster had been murdered and that Ron Brownstein's plane crash was done by ninjas or something. I mean, people think I'm making this up, but this was a real thing. And if you went and looked out into the fever swamps of conservative world and Republican world, those things were all out there even during the 90s. The difference was they really were the fever swamps.
Yeah. You know, I mean, they were in a box. You felt you could roll your eyes, but they were there. They were just out there.
And, you know, frankly, I think it is probably there's some culpability on the part of people like me and others sort of in what I have always thought of as sort of grown up conservative world for not really beating the crap out of these people back then, but for, you know, for treating them as sort of with eye rolling, like, oh, we don't even need to treat this stuff seriously because these people are so crazy. In fairness to us, I don't think we promoted them or looked the other way on them, but we didn't think that it was really necessary to go out of the way because they were so self-evidently ridiculous. But the same people who thought that Vince Foster was murdered believed that Barack Obama was born in Kenya and was a secret Muslim. And I've bought on with all the Sandy Hook stuff. And I'm just saying the Venn diagram of all of the people who believe in these things is a circle.
Yeah.
And that circle now is much, much closer to actual meaningful portions of political life than it used to be. And I don't want to overstate this. Like, Alex Jones does not work in the White House. But on the other hand, like, Donald Trump
played a role
on his show.
Yeah, no. I do think one of the turning points was when the Drudge Report started linking to Alex Jones, and then Alex Jones became, you know, a big booster of Donald Trump. Donald Trump went on his show the week after his election. Donald Trump, the president-elect of the United States, calls up Alex Jones and thanks him for his role. So here you had people who are on the absolute fringes of the fever swamp, and now they've been empowered. No, I share that guilt of, like, okay, you know, should we have pushed back harder? But I really, you know, just felt as they were moving closer and closer to the center. And I mean, this is this moment that we're in that so many people have not only not pushed back, but they've enabled them. And, you know, and I'm sorry to keep picking on him, but, you know, you mentioned Kurt Schlichter. I mean, the fact that you have guys like Hugh Hewitt who blurb his book and, you know, have him as their backup on their radio show. I mean, it's not just that they haven't pushed back on them. They've really empowered them.
They have. And in that case, it really is all about Trump. I mean, as a thought experiment, if you go down the list of people who are, as I sort of very carefully worded it, I think, do not present as normal, well-adjusted human beings. The type, yeah, of, like, so the Laura Loomers of the world, the Julie Kellys of the world. If you look at them and you see the degree to which semi-respectable Trump world will not pick fights with them, and in fact goes out of their way to excuse them, when Laura Loomer got upset about some 20-year-old LifeSite News reporter tweeting about her, she went and had the LifeSite News people fire him. I think it was LifeSite News. Maybe I'm misstating that. It was
no, I think that's right. Yeah.
All of this is because of Trump. If any of these people were Trump skeptics or never Trumpers, believe me, there would be nobody on, you know, sort of the mainstream conservative part of the world right now looking the other way on them. It is purely a courtesy because Trumpism demands that you not only support the parts of the Trump program that you like, but that you never criticize the parts of the Trump program that you know are preposterous. And it says the same thing even about Trump's enablers and the fellow travelers in Trump world, right? So this is, I said this in my piece, you notice that there are not a lot of people who say, I really want the wall and I really want conservative judges, but this North Korea policy stuff is batshit crazy. Nobody says that. Instead, they make excuses for why actually, you know, the North Korea stuff is really smarter than you think, and maybe it'll turn out okay, and you can't judge, and blah, blah. Things which are, even these people, I firmly believe, don't actually believe, but that they think is just part and parcel of it. Like, you got to be in for a penny, in for a pound with Trumpism, and that's different. It wasn't like that with Mitt Romney or George W. Bush or Bob Dole or George H.W. Bush. I don't even think it was like that with Reagan, actually. If you think about it, there was enormous fights within the Reagan White House between, like, the Gary Bowers of the world who are conservative and then, like, the James Bakers of the world who were trying to do more real politics stuff. And this really does extend outward even to the sphere of Trump supporters, where other Republicans would have been really felt free to crack back against people who were nominally on their side, but who they believed were unsavory, in the way like Bob Dole did at the Republican National Convention when he said, I don't want the support of white nationalists and white supremacists. You guys get out of here. If you think you're on my team, I promise you, you're mistaken. And instead, what we have in Trump world is we have a whole coterie of people in Trump world who are trying to alibi Trump for his Charlottesville statements, calling it a Charlottesville hoax.
The hoax.
You know, so that as if Trump never actually said all the things he said in defense of white nationalists. They just can't, you know, like this is, it's, I don't want to say it's like joining a cult, but it's a little bit like joining a cult.
No,
like
it's very, point, it's very, wonder, it is very much like joining a cult.
Yeah, like why is this? Why is this not? Why is this more like a cult than a political movement? Because political movements have all sorts of internal disagreements all the time.
You would think so. Okay, so Steve Kornacki from in NBC has a piece, you know, pointing out that Trump got no bounce from Mueller. You know, the president's approval rating just never is a flat line, which means that he's going to need a rival next year, as unpopular as Hillary Clinton was in 2016, to pull off a second term, which is a perfect segue to get into the power ranking, because I have this nagging sense that the Democrats, in fact, are committed to doing that, that they are committed to coming up with somebody who is just as unpopular or unpalatable. So you had on Thursday, The Secret Wars, the April Democratic Power Rankings. You do this every month, right? This is the official April.
Yes.
And listing the top 10. And as we speak, the number of Democratic candidates is growing. This Eric Swalwell is going to run on gun control. Tim Ryan, blue collar congressman from Ohio, apparently is getting in. Stacey Abrams, who still, by the way, has not conceded her election in Georgia, is apparently thinking of getting in. By the way, it's kind of interesting, the conversations. What is it? They're telling them the only way you will ever get on cable television over the next 2 years is to run for president, because there are so many candidates. Oh, really? What is the logic at this point to get in? You understand that if you don't announce for president, you will become invisible. The only – literally with all the candidates, there will be no time whatsoever. So you rank the top 10. Should we start at the top, number one?
Sure, let's start at the top. So I have had Bernie Sanders in the top slot since January, really. I think he is as strong as he looks and actually getting stronger. His polling is remarkably consistent. He's actually on an upward trajectory. He does just as well nationally as he does in both Iowa and New Hampshire. I mean, if you were looking at this his fundraising is off the hook. He is the guy who came in second last time. I mean, all of these things say that if you came down from Mars and were looking at this race, you didn't know anything about anybody, right? You don't know that he's a socialist. You don't know anybody's ages. You don't know anybody's races. You would look and you say, well, of course, Bernie Sanders is going to be the nominee. Why wouldn't he be? Don't you think? I mean, isn't that basically
no on paper, except that he's a 78-year-old crazy old white guy. You know, we were talking about Joe Biden before, you know, and his inappropriate touching. I just saw a video of Bernie Sanders apparently on the Bill Maher show, and I think he was on with Stephen Moore or something. And he's waving his arms, and there's a woman sitting in the middle, and the woman basically, like, you know, says, you know, stop waving your arm in front of me, and, you know, touches him. And, there are going to be so many videos of crazy Bernie Sanders. But again, I do have this sort of flashback to when people said there's no way that Donald Trump can win the nomination. I mean, Bernie Sanders is kind of like that. You know, he's kind of this crazy, curmudgeonly old guy. But you're absolutely right in terms of the numbers, in terms of the poll numbers, in terms of the organization, in terms of the dollars, he's got to be right up there.
So he's got $18 million raised in the first quarter from 525,000 individual donors. That's really, really impressive. And what it tells me is that those people aren't going away. I mean, I am not willing to say that Bernie Sanders is going to be the nominee, but I would bet money that he's in the final group of three. I mean, I just don't see any way that he isn't part of the final three here. And he's part of a movement. I mean, he has a reason he's running for president. You know, I mean, he wants to move America in a very particular direction. There is nobody else who is selling what he's selling as purely as what he's selling it. I don't know. I can see Bernie losing. But I see him winning much more easily. I think I said that if I was going to lay odds on this, I would probably call it 5-2, which means that you would take the field rather than him if you were looking to pick the winner and you were offered Bernie or the field, but only just. And I also think that the fracturing of the field, you know, having all these people here, makes him more, not less likely. We could be in April of next year and you could see this total anyone but Bernie panic erupting within the party as he, let's say he wins Iowa, comes in second in New Hampshire or flip-flop those. And we are heading out to California where there is a Kamala Harris victory baked in, and then South Carolina is on the horizon. And all of a sudden the Democratic Party starts praying that African-American voters save them by going in another direction. And I think that's a real possibility. You could see sort of thing where there's a tremendous pressure down the bottom half of this pack to get out so that they're, you know, your 1% that's right now sitting with Kirsten Gillibrand can go to candidate B, who is the alternative to Bernie.
Yeah, I guess my only question is that, yeah, he is distinctive, but he's not that distinctive. There's so many. I mean, if you want a progressive, there are the menu is broader. It's not just Bernie versus Hillary Clinton. It's like, okay, I want Bernie and I don't want Kamala Harris. I don't want Elizabeth Warren. We'll get to her in a moment. So they actually do have somewhat more palatable alternatives, although I think your analysis is right. Okay, so number two is still Joe Biden. We talked about him. You don't think that he's going to be derailed by the micro controversy over the hands?
No, I don't. And I think the real tell here is how does he handle the controversy? If he comes across as energetic and like a guy who still has his fastball, then I think the minute he declares, he becomes the favorite. As Joe Trippi says, you know, we've only had one case in which a former vice president has not gotten the nomination in like the last 70 years or something. And that was Dan Quayle. And his effort was really half hearted. I mean, he was barely in the race. So.
And I will say that Biden's best argument is electability, and it is interesting. You know, I was watching the punditry on the most woke of the cable networks, MSNBC, and in general, they're being very hands on. They're being sympathetic to Biden. I just don't sense that there is a
did you almost say hands off?
Yeah, that's kind of what I was about to say. Okay, so number three.
Beto, he's rising. So he's basically doubled where he was 8 weeks ago in the polls. People seem very excited in Iowa, where he has been spending most of his time. He's pitching post-partisan generational change. There's only one other candidate in the race, really, who is selling that, because Beto's pitch is much more generational than ideological. I mean, ideologically, nobody even knows what he thinks. I think it's possible he doesn't even know what he thinks. Mm-hmm. He really is a total blank slate for people to project whatever they want onto them. And that can be a very, very powerful thing. If you remember the 2000 Obama campaign, when really nobody knew Obama was selling himself as a pragmatist. He was like, I just like solutions that work. And nobody knew what that meant.
That worked, though.
So
number four is intriguing, because the conventional wisdom was that Kamala Harris had the most effective rollout. She's still getting good crowds. But you're saying, if you want to know how disappointing the campaign has been for Harris, consider this. She's sitting about where Beto is, but heading in the opposite direction. So what happened to Kamala Harris? And of course, we say what happened to, it's very early.
Yeah, I mean, she's the ultimate paper tiger, in my view. She has all the demographic boxes checked. She's a very smart lady. She, I think, clearly would be a perfectly competent or better chief executive. You know, when you look at her and you think, okay, she could be president. She's pretty smart. But the problem is she does not have a rationale for running for president, except for the fact that she really wants to be president. And voters smell that. They always, always smell that. And they care about it, too. If you look at the people who've become president over the last 40 or 50 years, there are very, very few people who have just wound up getting elected because they thought it was their turn and they had always wanted to be president, that it was just the next box for them to check. Now, this isn't to say that she doesn't have a real reason. Maybe she does, or maybe she's going to figure it out, but she's got to communicate it pretty soon, because all the other people in and around her have very clear and very clearly communicated ideas, right? So Biden is a return to normalcy and the continuation of the Obama legacy. Bernie is socialism. Beto is generational change. And then you get to Kamala Harris and it's like, hey, I'm a senator and I'm pretty smart and I'm not a crazy person. That's just not enough.
Yeah, she's raised about $12 million, which is not bad. In terms of, you know that there's going to be a big anti-Bernie faction in the Democratic Party. There'll be a big anti-Biden faction in the Democratic Party. But Kamala Harris seems like somebody who would be acceptable to almost all of the factions. So as the race plays out, though, she has the least negative, with the exception of the fact that she's apparently been tough on crime, which is anathema to certain circles in the progressive movement.
I think that's right. If the Democrats were going to do ranked choice voting, Kamala Harris could do very well. Mm-hmm. I would say this, and I sort of, in a way, it's too early to think about this, but in another way, it's never too early to think about this. The question is always, how many people can come out of New Hampshire, and what do you have to do in Iowa, New Hampshire to live to fight another day? Because Harris's whole game plan is like, I just got to get through Iowa, New Hampshire, and then everything will get good for me.
It doesn't generally work that way.
It doesn't generally work that way. So, I mean, I was thinking this through. It always depends based on the number of candidates in the race and stuff. My guess is that in order to get out of New Hampshire, you're going to have to be one or two in either Iowa or New Hampshire. And then you're going to have to, you're going to have to be third place in both. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe you could go four in Iowa and then three in New Hampshire and say, look at this, we're trending towards victory. But otherwise, there's going to be such a frenzy. There are going to be so many candidates. So many of these people are going to seem like they're clearly also lands. The money could dry up really fast.
So number five, you go with Mayor Pete Buttigieg. Do you pronounce it that way? Buttigieg?
Yeah, you know, I never either type it or say it because I know I'm going to get it wrong. I just call it Mayor Pete all the way.
Yeah, Mayor Pete. So you think this is actually happening. Now, the reason I'm asking this is because everybody's saying this is happening. This is real. You know, people are very interested in him. The Google searches are up. And yet the actual number is still in single digits. So why should we think this is really happening?
So he is right now really bound by name ID. His name ID is a fraction of every other single person in the field. That is an easy place for him to grow. You can grow name ID very, very quickly. What he has is the people who know him like him a ton. But you know that because he raised $7 million in the first quarter. Again, just to go back to Kamala Harris, if you had told her that the mayor from some college town in Indiana is going to raise more than half as much money in the first quarter as you, do you think you're doing well?
Yeah.
Right. She would have said, you know, oh, my God, push the panic button. He is David Brooks. You know, I couldn't quite figure out why people liked Mayor Pete. I was, you know, thinking about this a lot. The obvious thing is generational change. And he's the alternative to Beto. He's sort of the wonkier alternative to Beto. But Brooks, I think, really nailed this in a column this week. And he says that what Mayor Pete does is he takes progressive policy positions and then he detaches them from the culture war. In that if you look at the last, 20 years of American politics, beginning with 9/11, and you say that I don't want any more of this drama, I don't want the chimpy McHitler, I don't want the Obama birtherism stuff, I don't want the Trump wars, I want to go back to something better, then he is a very, very attractive commodity. Now, in practice, he'll just be another progressive.
Right.
I mean, but on the other hand, the affect matters. The affect matters a lot. I mean, that's what Republicans and conservatives seem to love about Trump. Like, I mean, Trump isn't actually all that different from your garden variety Mitt Romney type when it comes to policy outcomes. But they really like the fact that he fights. And people may really like the fact that Mayor Pete doesn't fight.
I asked this question of David Beiler just the other day. Is America ready for a gay president?
I'd be interested. I don't think it is. What did Beiler think?
He thought that it was. He thinks that you know, public opinion has shifted so dramatically. I'm a little bit skeptical until it actually happens.
Well, you know, if we're going to get a gay president, it would be somebody like Mayor Pete, who is gay but lives like the most conservative bourgeois lifestyle. Period. You know,
he's married, he's got
kids, he's a Christian, he's a vet. I mean, I sort of always assumed that like in most ways, like, you know, you assume that any sort of first minority is more likely to be from the opposition party just because they come with all sorts of built-in advantages that way. So, you know, I'd always assume that the first black president would be Colin Powell and he would be a Republican, yeah. You know, or that the first female president would be like Liddy Dole or something like that. But maybe it won't work out that way.
So number six, Elizabeth Warren, you say her campaign is over. She just doesn't know it yet.
Yeah, she's going the opposite direction today. She's down at like 6%. She's in fifth place, and it's really, really bad for her, I would say. You look at, you know, so in New Hampshire, which is a state I think she has to win, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
she was in the mid-teens like 8 weeks ago, and now she's at 7 in New Hampshire. I mean, like, when you look at this, it just, voters have decided they don't want her. And yeah. It isn't that they don't want what she's selling. They just don't want her. I think they actually like the message. And she's decided that the way she's going to dig out of this hole is with policy, that she's just going to do more homework than everybody else, and that voters will see that she's the one with a serious vision for actually having to achieve all these things. And I think she should talk to Jeb Bush about that.
Yeah, no, it's funny. I talked to Tim Miller about all of this, and he made the exact same point that, you know, that you know what determines whether or not you're going to be successful is whether you have that it factor, whether you have that personality. It's not whether you have, you know, 300-page white papers on Federal Reserve policy. You know, that is not what is going to get you through in American politics today. And Elizabeth Warren is going in that direction, and she clearly just doesn't have the charisma. Okay, so now we're down to the lower tier of the top 10, and of course, a lot of people don't even make the top 10. So you have Amy Klobuchar at number 7.
Yeah, so I think we should already start thinking about Iowa, New Hampshire, even though we are, you know, 7 months out. And the way to think when you get out of the top tier, you think, so how, what are the possible ways, what is the mechanism that people could, who are not there, could jump into the top tier? And the most obvious thing is you come from nowhere to shock the world in Iowa. This is a thing that happens, right? I mean, this is Dick Gephardt went from last to first in Iowa. And so of everybody else in this, who do you look at who looks most capable of pulling out a shock in Iowa? And I think it's Klobuchar. And I think it's actually pretty obviously Klobuchar. She's Midwestern. Her personality fits with Iowa very well. She's moderate. Maybe Biden's not in the race and there's no real moderate lane. I mean, you could see it. I'm not saying it's likely, but if you had to pick who is the most likely candidate to be able to make a big breakout in Iowa, I think she's it. And so that's why you've got to take her a little more seriously.
I have the sense, though, that she was hurt more by the, you know, eating salad with a comb, throwing stuff at her staffers than Biden was by the hands thing. I mean, Biden, you know, as we talked about that, those, you know, those were affectionate things. It was kind of like, okay, that's Joe being Joe, and it's not that offensive. Her stuff was mean, and that really cut against her image, that Minnesota nice image. And I just get the sense that she's never had the kind of affection and momentum since those stories came out.
I agree entirely. And it's because what she was portrayed as was an archetype that we all know. She's the bad boss. Mm-hmm. Everybody in America has had a bad boss.
Yep.
And everybody in America effing hates that guy or that woman. Right. I mean, we just loathe them. And so there are a lot of, you can be all sorts of heels and get away with it. You can be a rake the way Bill Clinton was. And some people will find it charming. There's nobody who finds any bad boss anywhere anything but abhorrent.
Yeah.
Like, that's a really bad thing to be.
And nobody buys the, well, I have to be tough if I'm going to go up against Vladimir Putin. Nah, that doesn't work. But given that, you still rank her ahead of Cory Booker, who at one time was, I mean, he was once the Beto O'Rourke of this race, right? I mean, you know, Senator Felty.
He was the Beto O'Rourke of the race back when he was mayor of Newark. Frankly, I think going to the Senate was bad for him. If he was Mayor Corey, I actually think he'd be much more interesting as a candidate right now.
Yeah, but who knew?
Who knew?
President, mayor.
Exactly right. Right. So yeah, I think the Cory Booker campaign is going nowhere fast. He will be an outstanding cabinet secretary in somebody's administration in 2022.
Kirsten Gillibrand, it's nice she's keeping AOC's Senate seat warm. Boy, that her candidacy is going nowhere.
It is, and she's going to make so many enemies because she is she does not play well with others in the Democratic caucus. She is not well liked at all by her colleagues, and I think she's going to be I think it's possible she's going to find herself out of step with New York State voters. I could very easily see AOC deciding to challenge her at some point if she gets impatient to move up. Although, for all we know, AOC might want to just stay in the House and run for president from the House.
So number 10 and JVL, you're trolling us here. You're just trolling.
I'm not. Andrew Yang. Yes. Oh. Right. We're going to have a look. Herman Cain is going on to the Federal Reserve Board because of 999, literally because of his 999 gimmick. If he had not run for president saying 999 at every debate 55 times, he would not be going to the Federal Reserve. Correct?
Correct.
And Andrew Yang has a thing. His thing is the universal basic income, which is the idea that we just got to pay everybody in America. When you're born, you are entitled to a check for, I don't know what his figure is, you know, call it $10,000, call it $20,000 every single year for the rest of your life. And that's just like your allowance from the government. This is a less stupid plan than it sounds. I think it is actually worth exploring. It may be a very, very, very bad idea. It could be that it is a good idea in very small types of societies, like that you could do it in Switzerland, but you can't do it in a country with, say, 300 million people. I don't know. But at some point, we're going to have an actual conversation about it in America. And so we might as well have it, but not during a presidential administration, I think, or rather during a presidential campaign. So he's going to get, I think, a lot of attention. People make fun of him for it, and then there will be a bunch of pieces from Vox and Slate saying, actually, the universal basic income is a great idea. And then we'll have a debate over it and he'll be up on the main stage. And then we'll actually get to the voting and the caucusing and we can usher him off and let him become eccentric again.
Yeah. So now we're at the end of the top 10. And basically, if you're not in the top 10, you're pretty much out of all of this, even though they're still piling on this race. I mean, Stacey Abrams, Tim Ryan, all of these other candidates. So you think that in the end, it's going to be one of these people, you know, in the end, if you're not in the top 10 right now, it's just not going to happen for you.
I believe so. With one possible exception.
Okay.
If Biden does not get into the race, then I believe there is an opening for some very big, very heavy white knight to come in late in the game. And I don't know if that person would be a Michelle Obama or an Oprah Winfrey or a Michael Bloomberg. But so let's pretend. So let's just game this out. Biden decides to take a pass. Bernie solidifies his place at the top. Mayor Pete climbs a little bit more and Beto sort of caps out and doesn't really go anywhere. And all of a sudden it is this summer and Democrats are looking around and saying, is this it? Is this really the team we're going to go to war against the bad orange man with? And there's a panic. And then you try to recruit somebody who you think is a savior. And I think it's possible that that could happen. Again, not likely, but that's the alternative scenario. I think that is much more likely to happen than somebody who is a declared candidate from the lower half of the race here making a jump.
There's always the fantasy candidate. I mean, I remember in 2016, you know, the amount of energy and time spent fantasizing about, well, Paul Ryan will get in at the last minute or there will be some sort of last thing. About the only person that would plausibly be able to do that, I would think, would be Michelle Obama. You know, given the fact that, I mean, and if she did do that, I mean, that would be, and that changes everything, obviously. But she's not going to.
She's probably not going to. But on the other hand, I mean, there are very few people in America who have the power to simply decide whether or not they want to be president. And if Michelle Obama were to decide that she wants to be president, then I would say she's got probably a 60% chance of becoming president.
Yeah.
There just aren't a lot of people who can do that.
It is not a crazy idea. So you don't see, we didn't even get to, I'm just looking at, you know, other candidates. So you don't think that Tulsi Gabbard is likely to be the nominee?
No, I think Julian Castro and Tulsi Gabbard are unlikely to be the nominee. Those people, by and large, looks like Jay Inslee has an idea and an issue he wants to highlight. And so that's like the same way Lindsey Graham ran for president. Lindsey Graham never thought he was going to be president. He just wanted people to talk about foreign policy. And I have total respect for that. And to be honest, I even have respect for the Tulsi Gabbards of the world who just think that, look, nothing bad can happen to you by running for president.
At this point, that's true.
Yeah.
You know, we have Governor Hickenlooper. I mean, think about where we're at here. You have governors of major states, and they barely make the mention. No, actually, my theory about why people are getting in at this point is probably as good as anything I can come up with, which is that, you know, does Tim Ryan actually think that he's going to be president? I did see somebody, you know, said that this is how Tim Ryan could actually, you know, win the nomination. He would be a plausible nominee, you know, running as a blue collar Ohio Democrat. I just don't see at this point how they're going to do it. But if you want to be mentioned, if you want to be a player, this is what you do. It's sort of the new branding. So,
yeah, if you're not Nancy Pelosi or Chuck Schumer and you're not running for president, but you're a Democrat, how will you get anybody to pay attention to anything you're saying? Right. Unless you're one of the two or three people running committee investigations of Trump.
OK,
what do you do?
Yeah. That's the problem, because, of course, those people will get tremendous amount of attention.
Right.
So, you know, you are a presidential candidate and you are competing against every committee chair in the House of Representatives as well. And who knows how that's going to play out. So, Jonathan, you do this every month. It'll be a May power ranking.
Yes.
OK.
Yes.
When does it get real? September, October?
I mean, I think it's real now, but where it's realest now is right in that cutoff line, you know, where the places number 5 through 8, which is if you're going to survive to be an actual contender, now is when you do that. You know, you got to start figuring out what it is you say. For Kamala Harris, it's very real right now, I think. If she does not figure out in the next few months what it is she's trying to say to people and what her rationale is for wanting to be president, then her campaign won't recover from that.
Yeah.
So people always say, like, you know, well, look at John McCain. John McCain was at the top of the list, and then he fell all the way to the bottom, and then he came all the way back. And the reason that all happened, though, was because of the environment. John Cain was the top of the list because he was running on saving Iraq. Then Iraq got unpopular, and he kept saying, we've got to be serious about Iraq. And then people started paying attention to what he said and decided that he was making sense. And so he came back. Because, you know what I'm saying? Like, he knew what he was doing all along when he was running that race in 2008. And it was just the voters that basically came around to him. The problem for a candidate like Harris is that she doesn't know what she's saying yet. And you have very little time to get people to hear you and understand what you're saying, to then let alone decide whether or not they want to be on board with that.
Yeah. Well, and also in terms of whether the Mayor Pete thing is real, you know, and again, I am not typical. I am not I'm not representative of anything, except that if you were to say you have a chance to go to one rally or watch one interview of any of these candidates, I would pick him because I'm curious. I want to hear it. The others, I pretty much know exactly what they're going to say, what they're going to do. I'll wait on all of that. But the fact that he has this moment where people are really paying attention, and a lot of the commentary is awfully interesting. I don't know if you saw Peter Weiner put out an email about Mayor Pete's religion and the fact that he's almost unique among the Democrats and talking about his faith in a certain way, as you point out, in a non-culture war way. And the fact that he's getting this kind of respectful commentary, and the fact that he's an interesting thinker and is unexpected. Yes, he would be a conventional progressive, you know, politician, but that's not the way he's presenting right now. And he's getting audiences that no one else is getting at the moment.
Yeah, I think, again, except for Beto. I think he and Beto are getting the same, going to the same place. In a weird way, I think he is more poised to capture older voters than Beto is. Precisely because of, like, the faith stuff. But Beto is fishing from a couple different ponds, right? I mean, he's trying to take the young Sanders supporters who are there for the socialism and bring them and have them be there for the generational crusade. And so I would say there's a good bit of overlap between he and Mayor Pete, but they still also have semi-distinct pools to fish from.
Yeah. I do think that maybe Beto also, would you call him Beto or Beto?
I have no idea. And so I flip back and forth.
I do too.
Since I figure I'm going to be wrong half the time anyway.
Exactly. Just say it confidently. I just think he burns too hot. that after you've watched him, you know, three or four times, it's like, okay, I've got it. It's too much. And given the fact that it's a marathon, I wonder whether he might peak a little bit too soon. Jonathan, thank you for joining me. You can read the whole thing, The Secret Wars, the April Democratic Power Rankings on The Bulwark. Hey, have a great weekend.
You too.
I will. And thank you for listening to The Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back on Monday, and we'll do this all over again.